James Turner.
James Turner.
Did you write stories when you were younger?
Yes, I did. And you are the first person in many years of asking questions who has asked me that. So I'm fascinated to remember that when I was your age, well, no, a bit older maybe, nine-ish. How old are you?
How old are you?
Seven.
Yes, so I was a wee bit older, but I was still at primary school. I wrote a long fairy story. And it's odd that you should ask me that, because the fairy story was about a princess who was really, really badly behaved, and a witch made her ugly. And as she learnt how to behave, she got prettier. How weird is that? James, you have uncovered my secret depths. How strange is that? I've forgotten about that completely. So yes, I did write. I wrote all the time. And then as I got older, I started writing sketches. And sketches are, you know, which you guys can write. You can write sketches. It's just dialogue. It's just characters and dialogue. You know, it's funny sketches that you watch on morning telly. There's lots of good sketch shows. And I'm sorry, I just ate your head. What is it? I'm sorry, I lost my head or something. There's a very good sketch show on the Saturday mornings that's for young people. Okay, I'm rambling now. I'll shut up now.
Charlotte.
Thank you, anyway. Great question.
Yeah, Charlotte Lawford. Hand up.
When you are writing, how long do you write for each day and where do you do it?
Oh, that's very interesting. Well, I write, if I'm in Scotland, I write in the bedroom, which sounds odd, but our bedroom is on the second, you know, it's a tiny little cottage and there's two floors and two rooms on the second floor. It's really small, but the window looks out on the river. So I write, and I write longhand. I don't write with a computer. I'm slightly odd like that. Also, I don't have a mobile phone, which makes me, you know, weird. But also, in a sense, safe and private. Anyway, so I write with a pen most of the scripts until I'm really late on, then I'll write on computers. And in London, I write in the sitting room where I have a little yellow table and it's got a... and it looks out onto the garden. So when I look up, I'm not looking at a wall, you know, because that happens in my brain sometimes. So I look up and I can see out to the birds or the trees. And I would recommend a view like that to writers. Water is particularly good. It sort of rushes through your brain and cleans you out. But that's where I write.
Chloe Wilkinson.
Have you ever been quiet for this long? I think it's remarkable. You all deserve medals. Nanny McPhee's. Where's Chloe?
Do you enjoy the writing or acting best?
Where are you, darling? Oh, there you go. Say again.
Do you enjoy the writing or acting best?
Well, you know, I started off doing more acting than writing in a way. Well, no, I started off writing things that I would then perform as a comedian. Then I started acting. And I didn't write the things that I was acting in. And I enjoyed that very, very much because it's less responsibility. And then when I started writing to act, the stuff that I'd written, I enjoyed that best of all. Because the combination of doing something very lonely for a long time and then acting with a lot of people was really lovely. So I would recommend that to anyone who likes writing and acting. The thing about writing, though, is that you can go anywhere and do anything in your mind, just in your head. You know, and if you're having a hard time, you can escape from any hard time through writing. So if someone said to me, for instance, you've got to choose now between writing and acting, I would write.
And that's leading us on to watching another part of you at work. You've already told us about the effect you've got of the children looking really startled at the kids synchronized swimming. So I can see this is you working in another way on set. So we've got a little featurette now about you working with the children.
Oh, crikey. I look rather good in that interview. I had professional hair and makeup done then. And a stylist. That's why I look so good.
My best bit is probably all the fighting scene where we all hit each other. Catching pigs, definitely.
Oh, that's a tough one, actually.
Driving the tractor.
At one point, Emma jumped into the pond. This was when we were doing the pigs jumping into the pond. So she pretended to be a pig and chucked herself into this pond, fully clothed, and started doing synchronised swimming in this
pond.
Funny.
It's been great. Everyone's been nice and it's been fun and sunny. And it's just been great.
The whole experience has been fun. We all get on well.
They're all absolutely remarkable. I'm amazed at what they've done. So I must say, I feel blessed every day with these kids. Cut to tomorrow, where they all turn into monsters immediately.
Abby Stoven.
There's Abby.
Over there.
What has been your favourite acting role?
I think
I've got two. Am I allowed two? Because Nanny McPhee's certainly top. Really tops, because it's so different and it's like mask work, really. And I get to be ugly and funny, which I like. And then I did another thing which was terribly serious about a woman dying of cancer called Wit, which was also a wonderful job because it had been written by a brilliant, brilliant playwright and it was about something very, very sad and difficult, but it was so well written that you didn't feel sad at the end, you just felt as though you just knew more about being human. That I loved. So those two things, very different, very different.
Lauren Woodall.
What memories do you have of the Magic Roundabout and would you like to make a live-action version?
The Magic Roundabout, you won't necessarily know about. Some of you will and some of you won't. It was a thing my father wrote, and it was animation, and it was about a very grumpy dog called Dougal and a bit of a sort of chirpy snail called Brian. And my dad wrote it when I was little, growing up, and he would be sitting there watching these little people moving about and then making stuff up. So it was like he'd been given a cartoon that didn't have any words or anything in it, and he watched the cartoon and made stuff up according to that. And that's a very good thing to do to practice writing, is you draw a cartoon and you give it to someone else, a friend, to do words in, you know, like word bubbles in. That's really good fun. So he was very inspiring because even though it was for children, he said, well, it's not, I can't write for children. What do you mean for children? What's different about children? They're just people who haven't lived as long as I have. Why should I write differently for them? Do they speak a different language? I don't think you do. Do you? You speak the same language. So what? He used to put complicated long words in, like he once used the phrase hoist with your own petard. It doesn't matter if you don't know what it means, but he used to get letters from parents saying, why do you use these long words and things for children? You shouldn't. It's a disgrace. And he would say, well, he was very naughty. He got out the Oxford English Dictionary and wrote back to this woman and included all the longest words he could find. And then he got a letter from another little lad, actually, who said, I called my sister a mollusk the other day and my mum thumped me. And he had to write back and say, no, mollusk is not a bad word. It's a snail. So it's not an insult, you know. So in a sense, he was the inspiration for me to write things that are not for children, but for everyone to share. Because I don't see the point of writing something just for one group of people. What's that for? I don't understand that. I can't do that.
End of question. We're going to have space for more questions in a minute, but after a bit of reading, because Emma's also written the novel of the film. And the novel's a unique work, I think, in that it's folding in the diary of the film, how the film's made. It actually seems to be written while you're making the film as well.
Yes, well, yeah. What happened was, I always keep a diary when I'm making a film, because you forget everything if you don't. And as I was writing the diary, I thought, I wonder if I shouldn't write the story of the film and then combine it with the diary of the making of the story of the film. And so that's what this book is. So if you're interested in the background of any of the characters or the story itself and you want to read it, it's in here. But if you're interested in filmmaking, everything you want to know about the crew, the making of the film, is all written in here as well. So this is very quick, but just to give you an idea, this is a little bit that Martin chose because it's about the car, and it's the diary, which is, I was on set writing this, so this is absolutely as it happens, and it goes, freezing today. For some reason, May has decided to be January. Curiously, yes, there's a resonance there, isn't there? It's freezing. We're all wearing four layers and fur hats. Well, I am. Poor Danny Mays, who is playing the chauffeur, Blenkinsop, do you remember him? Has to do a backward roll in the mud and fall into the duck pond. He's got a wetsuit on under his uniform, but still, no one told him he was going to be performing stunts, and he's being brilliant and excited about it and making us all laugh. At least it's not dark and not raining. I see we've got to quite an exciting part of the story, so let's go back to it. There's nothing much going on here. Lots of people standing about while other people push lamps through the mud, swearing quietly. I'm sitting in a patch of nettles, but at least I'm not in the way. Oh, wait, something has happened. Oscar, who plays Vincent, slipped over in the mud. He wins the slipping over in the mud prize, and it's £10. Now everyone is trying to slip over in the mud so they can win the £10 prize too, but it's too late. The story. Yes, the car was two colours, plum and Cadbury purple, and the chauffeur had a pale grey uniform with a purple stripe down the leg and a peaked cap. The children stared and stared. The Rolls-Royce purred up the lane like a big metal cat and pulled into the yard. Megsie was the first to realise what had happened. It must be the cousins, she breathed. But they're not due until tomorrow, said Norman. All three of them raced up to meet the magnificent vehicle as it pulled up by the farmhouse. Vincent was so awed that he couldn't close his mouth. He just stood there like a goldfish staring. They all expected, well, I'm not sure what they expected, the cousins to jump out shouting, hello, and I'm so-and-so, or we've brought presents from London, or even more likely, where's your loo? All the normal things that people say after a long journey, but there was a deathly silence from the car. Only the chauffeur, his face set like stone, hopped quickly out, straight into the mud, and opened the passenger door, standing smartly by it like a soldier. As the door opened, they all heard a strange, high, shrieking noise. Vincent went to look in at the window, and the shrieking became a sustained scream, which made him jump back in fright. Norman and Megsie stared as a boy with yellow hair stepped out gingerly. I say boy, but he looked far more like a perfect miniature adult. His hair was flaxen, which is another word for yellow, and flopped over his forehead in an I've got posh floppy hair way. He was wearing a yellow check suit belted at the waist and proper leather lace-ups. He was also carrying a copy of the Times newspaper and a large bar of chocolate, which he was busy munching. As soon as he clapped eyes on the chocolate, Vincent gasped. Is that a Fry's triple layer chocolate bar with Cinder Crunch topping? He asked breathlessly. There was nothing Vincent didn't know about Fry's chocolate. Before the war, he'd got into the habit of saving his pocket money, tuppence a week when times were good, a penny when they weren't. I know it doesn't sound like much, but these were the days when a penny would buy you four enormous toffee chews that could prevent speech for hours and once pulled out one of my uncle's molars. True. Didn't even make that up, and investing in a chocolate bar that he ate immensely slowly, sometimes over a period of several weeks. That's the sort of thing. So, you can have a read of that. Thank you very much, you're very kind.
It's a great story, and I love the chatty style that's there as well. We're now moving into that sort of freer chat space. And if anybody out there has got a question you want to ask, all you need to do is sort of make a bit of a noise and put up your hand.
Or just tell me to shut up and go away. That will also, I was certainly
acceptable.
Or
anything you just want to say. It doesn't have to be anything to ask. There's a question from the back up there.
And then you, mister.
Hi. When you've written a story and a screenplay, and you've obviously invested a lot of yourself into that process, and then you're performing that role, but you have a director. Obviously, you must have sort of an idea of how you want it to do it. So, kind of, is there a lot of conflict in that process, and who has the final say?
It's hell for the director, actually. You're right. There's not a lot of conflict because we always work with directors who are very collaborative. And I'm quite tactful. So if I think something's dreadfully wrong, I tend not to just rush into the middle of the set and scream, "This is all wrong!" You know, I try not to do that because that would be very awful. But at the same time, I do, as you say, have a very clear notion. Not so much the shots and everything, because that's not my art. That's not what I do. But the acting. So I do a lot of work with the children, and mostly it has to be said my directors, Kirk Jones for the first and Susanna for the second, are very grateful for that. Because if you've got a scene where you're dealing with a cow, a goat, some chickens, you know, four grown-up actors and five young actors, you sort of need another director on the set. So I do a lot of work with the children, because working with children is slightly different to working with adults. Because if you have to repeat something again and again, sometimes, if you're younger, it's very difficult to get that spontaneity. So I go to them. So say Amelia has to be excited. I say, "Amelia, can you look excited?" And I'll do, look, it's like, "Can you look excited?" And then she'll get my, and mirror it. Do you know what I mean? So therefore, you sort of need an actor to direct the children. You're absolutely right. Sometimes there is conflict, and it is difficult for directors to come onto a set with an actor who is also the writer. But I've been lucky because we've had very patient people.
Another question over. Oh, there's lots of questions coming up now. Let's just pass the microphone around. If you could just hand the microphone here, ask your question, then move it around.
Just pass it
down the line a bit.
There's lots to talk about, isn't there? Go on.
Was you shy meeting, like, loads of different actors, like Bill Bailey and that lot?
Well, I was, particularly Bill Bailey, who I worship. So I found it quite difficult not to just literally throw myself on the ground and just go, Bill, I love you. I thought that might embarrass him. So when I have an actor on set who's agreed, like Maggie Smith, you know, who, after all, is Maggie Smith and Professor McGonagall to boot, you know, you're so thrilled that you are quite a bit nervous, actually. So, yes, is the answer to that. Pass it down the line. Go on.
I think there's someone over there with
the mic. Oh, right. Go on.
What was your favourite book? Or your favourite author?
Give me an age that I should be to choose it. How old are you?
12.
Then it would be The Weird Stone of Brisingamen by Alan Garner, which is a magical tale. And Alan Garner is a fantastic writer. So, and that was one of my absolute top. And also, all the Sherlock Holmes stories by Arthur Conan Doyle. The Sherlock Holmes stories I was obsessed with from the age of 10 when I had flu, and my grandfather gave me his old copies. Those two. Nice question, thank you. I love books. Who's next?
You've got the mic.
Yeah.
Were there any scenes in the book Nurse Matilda that you couldn't put in the script because they would be too hard to film?
In the book Nurse Matilda? Well, the book Nurse Matilda doesn't actually... the only thing I've nicked from the book is the personality of Nanny McPhee, or Nurse Matilda, and Aunt Adelaide, because those books are slightly odd stories, because the children keep being naughty again and again for no reason, really, except they just feel like being naughty, which is fair enough. But if you're writing a story for film, they've got to have a reason. So one of my biggest jobs as writer was finding reasons for them to be naughty. So actually, most of it is invented. And in this second one, I invented it all. So again, it's an example of how to write. You can get an idea from a book and then take it on into your own imagination and go somewhere else with it, you know. Who's next?
Who's got the microphone?
Microphone there. Okay.
Who is the actor that you would want to be on set with?
Who would I want to be on set with?
What actor?
As actors, apart from George Clooney. All the women in the audience laugh like drains. Lots of people, actually. Most of them now dead, I have to say. But Zero Mostel was a very funny, big, fat actor I'd like to have worked with. There's a very rather serious American actor called Sean Penn who I'd like to work with. But I like working with any actors, actually, because they're often really nice and interesting people, and they're good fun. So, in fact, I don't really have kind of big actors. I just like most actors, really.
Okay, let's have a microphone from anywhere over that side, over there. And
yes, darling.
What encouraged you to make the first film of Nanny McPhee?
It was one of those odd things. I happened to be at home and I was wandering around my shelves, bookshelves, which I sometimes do, pulling things out and looking at them and thinking, why have I got that? I've never read it and I'm not going to read it now. I'm putting it back. And I took out Nurse Matilda, this little book, and I sat down and I looked at it. And one of the reasons I kept looking was because the pictures in it, the Nurse Matilda books, are beautiful. The illustrations are really gorgeous. And I kept looking at it. And when I finished reading it, I thought, making a film about someone who looks different at the end of the film than they do at the beginning is a very cinematic notion. Cinematic meaning it's filmy, you know, it's visual. It's something to look at that is interesting and that already tells a story. Do you know what I mean? So, like we were talking about, you know, petrol and twist, or one of the twists in the first film was, you know, the fact that she changed. And you thought, oh, that's a bit of story. You know, it gives you energy. So it was really that. It was reading the book, and then I rang my producer friend in LA and said, are you interested in this? And she said, go ahead, write it. And it took us 9 years to make the first one, because no one would give us the money. So there were some children who hadn't been born by the time they went to see it, and I'd been writing it since before they were born, you know.
Another question from, where's the microphone?
Yes, I see one there.
Yeah, good.
Do you know when you were dressing up, did you have to like wear corsets and things like that?
Corsets, not in, well, now, shall I tell you what I wear for Nanny McPhee, the full thing? It's, I've got little socks and little pointy boots. And then I've got a big, a fat suit. And then I've got pretend boobs. Which are very odd and look like gigantic skinless chicken breasts. And you put them into two, they put them over my boobs and they fit in like that and they've got little pockets. And if you really want to scare people, you can just whip them out. which I did when we were working with the horse guards in the horse guard parade. So they were all looking up at me and I was standing there and I said, hello! And they were just, oh, grown men, you know, there were swords jangling and horses going, oh, frightened the horses with that. Then there's a little front thing so that I'm bigger, and then there's a hump at the back. Then there's a big petticoat, then there's another big black skirt, another jacket, then there's a big, long and very heavy cape, as well as a wig, the nose, the eyebrows, the ears, the warts, the hat, and the stick, and they have to even sort of stipple my hands. And it all takes about an hour and a half, which is not long enough for my liking, to make me look that ugly, do you know what I mean? I said, is that all the time it's going to take? For goodness sake, can't we say it takes 4 hours or something? It's an hour and a half, it's nothing. It takes longer to make me look like, in the you know, nice. Anyway, and it's very hot, very, very, very hot. And if I get too hot, I have to take it all off and take half an hour to cool down, because I'm like one of those zoo animals, like a hippo or an elephant, that overheats and then has to be hosed down for an hour. Because then if I get too hot, the glue of the makeup starts to come away and then my nose comes off. And that costs money. Not because the noses are expensive, although in fact they are, but because time on a film set is always very expensive.
So a question from over that side of the room.
How many actors were in the film?
Oh, crikey. I don't know. Let's count them. 5 children, 7 adults, 12-ish. It's not more than that, I don't think. And then the cows, of course, and the goat, and the jackdaws, and the piglets. So, you know, quite a number. It's quite a complicated thing to shoot when you've got that many actors.
So, one question down here.
Do you know the woman who owns the shop?
Mm.
Is she the baby from the last film?
Yeah. I just put it in... It's not an important thing, but I just thought... I quite like, if I write a modern one, I quite like to continue that strange connection. It doesn't mean it's the same family or anything, you know, because she isn't from that family. She just happens to be in the vicinity and she remembers. I mean, she can't remember because she was a little baby, but that's the rattle from the first film. So well spotted.
Are there any questions from the gallery?
Shout them. Shout it.
There's a microphone there.
Do I get to keep the costumes? Where on earth would I wear the blinking costumes? What, out to Pizza Express? I don't think so.
Though, didn't you say that you actually went out to
I did.
Meal in a restaurant?
It just shows you how forbearing the British are. I went to a tapas bar in the full Nanny McPhee outfit and nobody took any notice at all. Yes, Signora, what would you like? I'd like some ham, please. Jamon, yes, of course. And he went on, I thought, hello, aren't you worried one of my warts is going to drop in to your tapas? Yes?
What do you do when you get stuck?
Stuck in what sense?
When you're writing the book.
I tend to go and walk and do, it's a very, very good question. I tend to go and walk away and do something else. But the other thing I do is I make myself carry on, even though I think what I'm writing is rubbish. And it's a very interesting exercise because you come back the next day thinking everything I wrote was rubbish, and then you find one or two things that aren't rubbish. So when you do get stuck, my advice is to try and carry on, actually.
Well, now, Emma's said she's a bit stuck at the moment looking for the idea for Nanny McPhee. Nanny McPhee, there we go.
That's the new working title.
So... perhaps this is the time, in the last sort of couple of minutes, for us to sort of feed back some ideas that you might have. So we're running out of time for questions because buses are coming at 4:15, which is in like 2 or 3 minutes away. So we've got just 2 or 3 minutes to feed back these ideas for Emma. Do you have an
idea? Has anyone got one? Yeah, go on.
And maybe you could like, do you know, like maybe you could have like an English person who's causing trouble with the Americans.
Well, I mean, she is that, isn't she? Because she's English. She's going to say English. She's not going to be, I hear you've been naughty. That would really not work, would it? I think she's the English person who they then... Or I think that, like, someone should try and get her to a dentist. I think that'd be quite funny, because all Americans have those strange white teeth, don't they? So, but definitely, I think she causes havoc. Okay. So I think that's a very good notion, that she causes terrible trouble.
Any more ideas?
There's one lady there.
Yeah, OK, good.
Shout it out. Well, exactly. So I thought if it's computers, don't you think it would be fun if the way they first hear... the way she works, I need to explain to you the way I work, it should come up on the computer screen, because they won't turn away from their computers. Do you think that would work? Because you guys always... I mean, is that the sort of row that you have with your parents? Is it, or will you please turn off your computer or come off the iPod? Or is that the kind of thing that's going on? Yes. Thought so. OK. Yes, darling? You've got the microphone. Yeah, go on.
Shouldn't you have, like, kids living in the Empire State Building?
That would be great, actually. I was wondering about that, because then everyone would know immediately that it was New York, wouldn't they? So I think I might do that. That's a very good idea. Thank you very much. And I'm glad you had it too, because that means that backs it up. That's very good.
Two more ideas, and then we'll see. Thanks. So an idea from over there?
I think you could, like, set the scene in Hull here because, because, like, we have a bad reputation of, like, dropping our H's and stuff. So we could have, like, naughty kids in Hull.
Nanny McPhee goes to Hull.
one final one, one final idea. The microphone's being rushed to the back. Here we go.
I think you should have a mix of teenagers and kids, and they're watching the TV and it goes blank because Nanny McPhee comes in and they get really angry and they start smashing all the technology up.
Great idea. Yes. That's a great idea. So a mixture of teenagers, have some teens in this one, you think?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think that's a good idea. I do, because I think it needs to be slightly different, you know. And if it's going to be New York, yeah.
You want one more? Okay, one more from up there at the top.
Shout!
You could have Nanny McPhee banning them from, like, electric toys, and they have to use like, old-fashioned stuff.
So they have to go kind of, yes. What about if they started controlling each other by remotes? That might be fun, mightn't it? That's a good idea, though. Absolutely, it's sort of taking them away from just the screen to actually talking to each other.
I can see you're absolutely right, Emma, that everybody here has got a story.
No, you could all write it now. You could all actually write it now. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you start thinking about, well, how are they going to be naughty and how is she going to work it out? I have to say, you've been the most extraordinary audience. You've been absolutely unbelievable because it's a very long time to sit. And I don't know how you've done it, really. I'm so impressed. And all your questions have been so brilliant and intelligent and helpful and clarifying, and thank you so much for having me.
Amelia wants to say thank you.
Oh, Amelia's going to say thank you. Yes, I'm so sorry. That's for you. That's a speech.
I would just like to say a big, big thank you for, like, taking your time to come and meet us all. And it's been an absolute pleasure, and we look forward to seeing you again, maybe.
Would you have said that if I'd been an absolute disaster? You've got that written down. What would you have said if I'd just sat here going, yes, no, bleh, you know, if I'd been a really bad interviewee? I think you're very polite. You probably would have said it even so.
I don't know, because you still come to see us all, really, so...
So you think that even if I'd just sat here like a lump of old coal?
Well, you won't. I know you won't really say stuff like that.
Thank you very much.
Jack and Amelia, obviously Emma, and I think we have some presents from Lauren coming up from the wings.
Presents.
Are we around Lauren?
Oh.
Oh, we go.
Oh, flowers. Oh, thank you so much. Thank you. That's very kind. Thank you so, so much.
It's been a joy having you here. Don't go up too fast, then you can come back next year for the next children's writing event. And it's a delight for us to have had Emma bringing it to life in such a real way and having such a wonderful dialogue. It's been wonderful to hear your questions. I'm sorry we can't run on till 8 because I'm enjoying myself. But terrific. Thanks for coming. See you next year.
See you next year. Come on then, kids.